Welcome, Blind Spot Insider. Thank you for submitting questions for this episode. Here are the responses to your questions. So the first Blind Spot Insider question is from someone who wants to understand, how should a business evaluate potential marketing and advertising firms to hire that will align with them, whether it's size, culture, price? Wanted to get your insight on that.
Oh man, this is such a good question. I do love this question because I think the right firm or the right even marketing person or the right boutique agency or the right agency for the right company is like magic. And when you find it, really good things can happen. I'm extremely biased in one area here, as you can imagine, being on the agency side. But over the last probably half decade, I've been hired by a lot of brands to help them in this process. I've recommended agencies. I've been a CMO for startups, for highly funded, well-funded startups, and have hired advertising agencies. So I've had some side on the other side of the desk. Some things I think to consider in this process are, work with people, hire people that you will like to hang out with and that you would like to work with, because it's unlike a lot of other, relationships in business where, you're hiring bolts or you're hiring someone to build a road. Like you're hiring something for a specific thing. An advertising agency is really a company that you're hiring to represent the consumer and to dive into your deepest stuff and to basically marry what the company's great at with what the consumer wants and needs. And so it's a very intimate relationship, and you're gonna ultimately have to be working with people you like. So that's the first thing I would say, is hire someone that you can, you like hanging out with. Don't design a agency RFP process that is giving them a very specific assignment to solve a business problem with creative. Because a lot of times what happens is the best idea wins the pitch for the business, but the best agency isn't hired for the business need. And most ideas in a pitch will never happen, because you will deep dive and you'll go through a process and there's some things the agency didn't know in the RFP process. I've hardly ever heard of a pitch that wins an account based on a creative idea that creative idea gets executed. So people that design an agency pitch for a specific creative idea, let's say there's 8 agencies in the pitch or there's 6 agencies in the pitch, that's kind of an old school way of doing things, where you're hiring the agency that had the best pitch. There's so many factors. They could have their A team on the pitch, and then once you hire them, then the C team gets on the business. They could be really, really great at creative, but really crappy at buying media or actually executing. There's so many things that in once you hire them are so much different than the sales pitch, right? And so I love processes, and I think processes that are most effective are where you find out about the agency, what they've done in your category. I think category experience is very undervalued in the process. So if you're a bank and the agency has great credentials and capabilities around banking, it's going to save you a lot of time and money working with people that know your industry. What does their team look like? How are they to work with? What's their personality like? Giving them the actual fees and marketing budget to see how competitive they are from a value standpoint. I think those are more useful exercises to really find out the agency you want. If I was doing a pitch for an agency, I would probably talk to 6 agencies and I would talk for anywhere from boutiques to larger. I would really look for, I'd want to be an account that was kind of in the top middle half of their account list. Right. So let's say I have $1 million in fees or $500,000 in fees to hire an agency. I wouldn't want to be the smallest account on their roster, but I wouldn't want to be the biggest. I'd want to be towards the biggest, but not the biggest. Right. Okay. I'd want them to have category expertise, and I'd want to know exactly who's working on my business day to day, not who their pitch team is. I'd want to know the percentage of time on my business. I would want, you know, a longer term contract with some outs. And I'd want to make sure that they understood the category that I work in, and I wouldn't have to train them for the next year on how that industry and our category works. And that's how I would look to hire an agency. And then I would want someone on my side, on the account side, that was a marketing person working with them. So I think it's a disaster to have a CEO or someone other than a marketing person air trafficking, controlling the agency. And I'd want that marketing person day to day to have an input on who they want to work with, because ultimately the agency's got to make that person look good. And an agency just going straight to someone who's not a sophisticated marketer is a disaster. It will blow up because they don't know how to work with an agency. And if I were an agency, in fact, I require now, I won't work with somebody who's not a sophisticated marketer as an agency. Won't do it because I know it won't be successful.
That's really good insight. And so even if the company doesn't necessarily have, quote, a marketing department, having a fractional CMO in place that's representing you in that role.
I love fractional CMOs. I work with a lot of fractional CMOs today. I act as a fractional CMO at times for brands. I'm working for, I think, two or three right now, because I'm literally just helping the agencies and the marketers bridge the gap between the other people, because they don't know. They don't know what to ask for. They don't know what's a good price. They're constantly thinking, oh, $200,000 for a production, is that too much? Or $1 million for a production? Like, they need someone to like calm them down and say, look, yes, this is, they're doing it right. Like, they're providing good value. This is normal in an agency business. You know, hey, they missed a deadline. It's one deadline. Give them a break. Okay. Like, we put, you know, three things on them and they've worked this over this weekend to get this done. And so, yeah, I see fractional CMOs or credible marketing directors or VP of marketing is fine. But yeah, I think that's a big point. Or, you know, maybe if you're the CEO, but you have a lot of marketing experience, okay, then maybe an agency can work out well. And I think more professional service agencies are going to be even more relevant because they're going to be able to leverage more AI. And so they're going to be able to get a lot more stuff done cheaper than they could have, you know, 2 years ago. And that's why a lot of the big in-house marketing departments have increased in size, just frankly, because they had to get thousands of pieces of content done a month for all the channels. Now agencies eventually leveraging more AI, I think professional service agencies and boutique agencies are going to become much more attractive, especially to mid-market companies, because I think the value that they offer and the thinking that they'll provide will be much more efficient.
Well, terrific. Okay, so our second question is, what strategies do you recommend for businesses with limited budgets looking to acquire customers efficiently and effectively?
So that's a great question. I think the biggest missed opportunity from a tactic perspective, especially for B2B companies or smaller B2C companies or mid-market companies, is PR and thought leadership. I'm a big fan of PR. Now, again, it's not trackable, so the CFOs don't love it because it's squishy. It's brand stuff. People... want to hire companies or other people based on, you know, the clout that they have and based on what other people are saying about them and based on their reputation, right? And as much as journalism today has, you know, probably gone backwards a little bit, truthfully, and it's getting certainly hammered by most consumers today, it's still very powerful. Whether that's an influencer, a podcast, a traditional news station, a community newspaper, having other people give you endorsement by coming on their show or on their media means something. And that can also be re-leveraged in other social channels. So, you know, for example, this podcast, I can reshare on my channel and it says to my 13,000, you know, LinkedIn subscribers and connections that I'm credible about marketing. Right. Why? Because Larry Gordon and his podcast think so, right? It psychologically really matters to consumers. And so to me, PR is almost always in any business category, the lowest hanging fruit to get the biggest bang for your buck. Now, the problem is it's not going to sell any specific product that you can track. Right. So, which is, again, why I think it's undervalued, because people want that performance marketing channel. If you need to sell product, and if you're in the product sales business, I think TikTok and Amazon are really underrated, especially Amazon. I even think Amazon's underrated as an ad platform. I mean, it's the 100-pound gorilla in the room. If you're in B2B, I think sports sponsorship is underrated. And I think event production is very underrated. So if I was in B2B, I would be doing more intimate events for potential customers and existing customers. Arming my salespeople with dinner budgets, bar budgets, event budgets, sports ticket budgets, that's the best money spent in terms of sales. And let's face it, sales make it happen. So as a marketing guy, you got to be about sales. And any way, if you're a smaller company, to have a sales force, that's the cheapest form of marketing out there. And arming them with goodies for potential people, whether that's trips to country clubs for golf, whether that's, you know, anything you can think of that's experiential for existing or future companies, that is the best money spent and often overlooked by marketing people. They're like, oh, we need to do an Instagram post. Like, no, you don't. Take 100 customers, you know, to the Masters. Spend, right? Go, you know, take your top 10 customers and a couple of potential customers to Pebble Beach for the weekend. Why don't you spend your marketing dollars on that? That'll work.
Okay. Those are good insights. So then the third question is, how do you address the challenges of customer retention and lifetime value after the initial acquisition phase?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it comes down to truly being unique. You know, more and more studies say that Gen Z and millennials do not have the brand loyalty that we're used to in this country. You know, if you talk to boomers and Xers, they drink the same beer. They want to drive the same brand of car. They have the same sports team they've had for 15, 20 years. They're very loyal, sometimes even in case being in the same job. Millennials and Xers, millennials and Zs, and I, you know, I'm an Xer / millennial, kind of on the border. We're very much more open-minded to switching. And so that creates certainly an opportunity for new brands, but it creates a challenge for people that want to retain customers. And again, I go back to experiential. If you're not providing some sort of experience for your customers, on every level of the purchase, you know, triangle, upside down triangle, then, I think people are absolutely going to switch. And there's some great brands out there that do it. If you look at companies like Patagonia versus their competitor North Face, and what Patagonia does from an experiential standpoint and from a brand quality standpoint, it's a no-brainer. If you look at Yeti, I mean, there's a million coolers that are better than Yeti, okay? But Yeti is the most expensive, and people love it. And you could be a, you know, right-wing Republican in Florida that likes Yeti, and you can be, you know, kind of a little more liberal, you know, hippie that lives in Washington and love Yeti. They have both. I've never seen anything like it. You know, same thing if you look at like the auto brands, whether, you know, it's Ford versus Chevy versus Toyota. They're all finding ways to add experience to those customers because they want them to continue to buy their car and be aligned with it. And it's very difficult, but absolutely can be done. I do think finding ways to check in on them. I think brands have spent so much time acquiring customers, and now we're now figuring, hey, we should probably just keep the ones we have. So for me, I'm in professional services. I probably have, you know, 50 different clients, and I've been a, you know, Inc. 500, Inc. 5000 company multiple years in a row, and I love growing. But at the end of the day, you know, love who you have. And there are great exercises with people much smarter than I am that, you know, go through your 80-20 rule and find out, you know, typically 80% of your business is from 20% of your clients. So taking those 20% of your clients, and maybe you're not going to keep everyone, but keep your top 20.
Right.
And it comes down to money, right? Spend money on those 20% and really think about it. That's been some relearning for me. This last 2 or 3 years, I have really spent a lot of time with the 20%, top 20% of my my business, which is like 4 clients. Okay. and so I think reallocating some money to your best clients. And then I think in professional services, and I think this can even extend on to B2C brands as well, but there's a lot of customers that aren't worth it and are bad customers and are actually cost you money. Having the courage to walk away from those so you can provide more value to the ones who are good customers. I think that's a big missed opportunity. And I think a lot of the ad tech in the business and a lot of really good data-driven marketers are leading brands astray by focusing on the wrong KPI that's actually costing them money because they're just focused on converting customers off the bat that frankly aren't good customers. And on paper, it looks like a great conversion, but in actuality, over time, it's terrible. And so, finding the right customers at the right time early on the conversion cycle, and then really focusing on your biggest customers, which is really 80% of your business in most cases, making sure they're happy. I think, you know, then if you look at your loyalty numbers and okay, you're losing 10% a year, but you're keeping your biggest and then you're converting better customers in the funnel that could be even bigger customers upside. Well, then who cares if you're losing 10%? Because you're ultimately making the right decisions to be more profitable and to grow for the future.
So really you're top grading at that point.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And look, the bottom 10% of your customer base is going to be coupon value-driven shoppers, right? That have low margin. Maybe you don't want those customers. Amazon is a prime example. It's a great channel for selling goods and services. One of the best. It's very SEO-driven. So I need a golf speaker. I need a coffee mug. I need whatever you need. I need a screwdriver, right? And I need it in 24 hours. Someone might buy that, but Amazon's going to hammer you on the margins. And then you have no customer information for loyalty down the road. So you're selling product at a low margin and you're probably getting some volume, but I guarantee there's another 30 competitors selling screwdrivers or whatever you're selling on Amazon. Let's face it. And so you're going to go, damn, you know, I have their email address, but they're dropping off. They're unsubscribing, you know, in a year. Well, they just needed a quick screwdriver and you were the cheapest one on Amazon. So I think there's a lot of scenarios in that manner. But, you know, if you make the best screwdrivers in the world and, you know, and you're packaging that up with, you know, someone who shows you how to do different things around your home with a screwdriver, I don't know, like some influencer, if you're packaging it up and it means more than just the screwdriver and it's all these tools or it's betterment of your home, or it's learning how to be a better handyman at home, or whatever that is. If you're more than just the screwdriver and you're providing more content, more experience, more value, that's how you're going to compete customers, I think. And it relates to B2C and B2B too. But it's a great question, but what it's not about is, you know, changing the font and, you know, packaging your email blast, right? I don't think that is going to ultimately, you know, really help, you know, your longevity to customers ultimately.
Well, terrific. And our last question is from a person who sits on the board of directors of their company. And he wants to know, he wants to make sure that he can ask the right questions of the management team about their 2024 marketing budgets and objectives so that he comes across doing his fiduciary responsibility by being able to probe. And he's not sure, he goes on to say about how far in the weeds does he get? How does he kind of get comfortable that they're taking the right path?
Oh man, this is such a good question. And I'm already thinking about it. And truthfully, if someone on the board was probing really hard in marketing, I think it could go one of two ways. If it were me presenting or other marketing people that I know have similar backgrounds as me. And I think one way is I could get pretty defensive pretty quickly, especially if it was in a group setting. The other way is I'd be really excited because someone actually gave a shit about marketing, excuse my language, and were asking really smart, detailed questions that I could answer effectively and efficiently in front of a big room that would, first of all, show that I know what I'm talking about and that we could get alignment if there is questions rather than questions down the road. That weren't fully squared out. Cause I've seen marketing presentations go where everyone's like, "Yep, everything's good. This looks great." And they weren't really into it, and I've seen others where people ask questions that aren't intelligent and their criticisms and their questions and comments that aren't backed with data and they're backed with a lot of bias. Mm-hmm. Like, I watch TV and I've seen X, Y, and Z, or I've seen this brand is doing X, Y, and Z, or my wife saw this and thought it looked this way. Those are comments as a consumer, not smart marketing questions. So if he, as a board member, is asking, I think, smart, detailed question about budget and budget allocation and ultimately the plan, I would welcome those if it's done in that manner. If it's done in a manner without the data, and done in a form of consumer bias, I would get really frustrated. And my comment would be into a lot of people that are asking marketing questions, depending on how they ask, it would be like me asking a brilliant accountant, you know, questions about 1031s. And arguing with them about, you know, well, I heard, you know, this 1031, and be like, what are you talking about, dude? You're not an accountant. You're a marketing guy. Right. What gives you the basis of this question? So, and maybe one thing to consider is to maybe talk to the marketing people ahead of time and let them know that you're asking these questions, as a fiduciary, because you want to spark, debate and to get alignment. So it's not catching somebody off guard, because marketing people can get, I mean, we're creative, right? So I think we can get defensive very easily. And so if they know it's coming and that there's going to be, you know, good questions, you don't even have to tell them the questions ahead of time, but just, giving them the heads up that you really want to make sure there's complete alignment. Questions about marketing allocation by tactic or by channel or by function are great debate questions. And most of the questions that I see from sophisticated, smart people, especially finance people, have to do with allocation. And those are very healthy debates. And good marketing people will have data to support those decisions. Hey, we're doing connected TV because 82% of our audience watches connected TV. We're doing influencer marketing at this percentage because we think there's this, and this opportunity. And so if somebody on the board was saying, do you think we should do more influencer marketing versus more connected TV and why the allocation of budget is what it is, I think that's healthy debate. Really, really healthy debate. And it's one that is not set in stone. It's something that, you know, we're making educated guesses toward, you know, for the brand. And so I think those are healthy questions. Now, on the performance marketing side, if you have questions about conversions or anything like that, I think if you look at really sophisticated Fortune 5000 companies, definitely Fortune 1000, they've implemented and armed their CMOs with like financial CFOs for the marketing department. So I would absolutely, and I think it's genius, a guy who I have on my show a ton, who've been the CMO at Best Buy, Farmers Insurance, been everywhere, really smart guy. This is the first time I've heard this concept where, you know, big companies and their CMOs would have their own CFO, and that marketing CFO would go with the CMO to talk to the overall board. and they would be able to talk better financial language. And then marketing can, really come to the right modeling and the right structure of their presentations that, financial people understand. And I love CFOs. I also hate CFOs. Like they're the complete opposite of me and most really good marketing people. And so there's going to be friction just based on personality type and how people see the world. It's the yin and yang. And understanding that, the language of business is financial, right? And so good marketers hopefully are starting to really understand that. But I think good CFOs are understanding the power behind really creative marketing in a hyper-competitive world. And so I think friction is good, and having places to air that friction can be incredibly healthy. And I think a great opportunity if structured the right way and if framed the right way. And depending on who the marketing person is in the room, if they're ultra creative, understanding how to probe questions in the right manner and provide feedback, more importantly, in the right manner. And there's whole classes on how to give creative feedback. It's definitely a skill. So if this is more business plan prodding and poking and understanding, done in the right setting, I think can be very healthy.
I think that's great insight, and it helps board directors understand how to approach to get the information they're looking at, as opposed to setting up that defensive, unhealthy friction, being able to help get alignment to be able to understand and make sure that the expectations are met for all parties.
Yeah. And maybe even, hey, we're going to provide our CFO, we're going to let him spend, two or three days with you. And maybe you guys could get alignment on this model. We love the business plan. We love the brand positioning. You've really set this up in the right way. Now we're getting to the area of spending $500,000, $2 million, $10 million. And I see all these allocations of budgets. Maybe there's a way, again, said and done the right way, to where, some financial support can be given to marketing, and alignment can happen even before a surprise board meeting where they feel like they're getting hammered.
Right. Right. Hope this was insightful. If you have a friend or associate that would benefit from hearing these responses, please have them sign up to become a Blind Spot Insider. We appreciate you being on this journey with us to create more I've Got This victories.